Welcome to Leadership Decoded, a weekly podcast where, through insights and interviews, I explore what good leadership looks like. My main aim is to keep the podcast long enough to cover the subject, but short enough to create interest and without a zoom. So please sit back and enjoy this episode of Leadership Decoded. It's been a while, and to be really honest with you, I've just been lazy. I've been writing and running courses and webinars and haven't really put the effort and energy back into making sure that we have a consistent stream of these podcasts. However, in the last week, in a mastermind group that my wife and I run, called Dream Hustle Build, dreamhustlebuild.com, where we help startup entrepreneurs to take their ideas to execution. One of the attendees challenged me. And basically she said, David, my challenge for you this week is to make sure that you record the new series of the podcast that you have around leadership communication. And I was a bit taken aback, actually. I thought, well, that's very cheeky. But I thought, you know what, Joanne? And yes, I'm putting your name out there. I'm going to take you up on your challenge. And I'm going to make sure that I get my first episode of the new season, or second episode of the new season, up and running by April the 13th, which of course is today, 2020. And I really like that. And it's ironic that the challenge, or should I say the subject for today's podcast, is around decision making. And even though I've been holding off for a little bit around the decision of being able to record for this podcast, here I am. And I am trying to commit myself. Obviously, I'm not going anywhere. So I'm going to try to commit myself in these COVID times to make sure that I consistently get back into the habit of releasing this on a weekly basis. So today's episode, as I said, I want to focus on decision making for leaders. And why, for me, I think it's so important that leaders do really think about how they're going to make decisions for themselves and their teams, and how they're going to be able to do that quite effectively by using a number of tools. So I want to start off actually by referencing a story. And a story that I heard this week. So basically, last week, and again, did I say this week? I meant last week. But last week I read a story in, a story on a website. And it was about the scooter company called Bird. Essentially, the background for this is that there was an arrangement for a Zoom webinar for about 400 plus employees of Zoom who were told to log in for this free-flowing meeting. And essentially what happened was that people had logged into it, and when they got there, rather than it being video, what they saw was a couple of slides about some challenges that were ahead for the company. So when they actually logged in and they typed, and actually the webinar started, there was a voice online. And obviously this employee, whoever they were, started speaking. If you go online and you can search anywhere, go and search for Bird layoffs and you'll find it yourself. And you'll see the audio recording. But essentially, they decided that morning that they were going to release this voice note that was sent out to a number of people. And the voice note essentially told them that they were all going to be laid off. That whilst they were sitting down there just expecting, standard message, that there was this message that was given to them that they were effectively told that they were going to leave. A lot of people said they didn't recognize the voice of the person. It wasn't any one of the chief executives. But it was a random voice that came on and started to tell them about the future of the company. I'll quote some of the bits that I got from the interview here. So the woman who was speaking said, "This is a suboptimal way to deliver this message. COVID-19 has had a massive impact on our business, one that has forced our leadership team and our board of directors to make extremely difficult and painful decisions. One of those decisions is to eliminate a number of roles at the company. Unfortunately, your role is impacted by this decision. This message went on for 2 minutes, and then that was it. After this, all the individuals who had logged on the company laptop, basically their laptops restarted and were ended. Now, subsequent to this, there's a backstory where you find out that a member of IT was told to write a script that would basically take people off the system if necessary, if an announcement was made, and then obviously restart their machines. This script was run for the 400 odd people that were on this actual call. Their machines rebooted, and then they could not log back into Slack to talk to colleagues about what happened. Neither could they go back and see what the webinar is. And the only way a lot of them were able to contact was by LinkedIn, where individuals actually went onto LinkedIn and found a way of being able to just check them to see if other members of staff had found out what was actually happening. And then when they exchanged stories, they realized that 400 of them had been sacked by this suboptimal method of putting people on a Zoom call. And when I heard that, it shocked me. It actually shocked me to the core. Firstly, because I wanted to know how an executive team decided by sitting down together that this was the best way and the best method of being able to tell the employees that they were going to lose their job. Now, personally, as a senior leader, I believe that the leader should have had the testicular fortitude to at least put his face, or one of the senior leader team, if there was women on the team as well, you know, men or women, to be able to put their face on the actual screen with the slides, pin it to Zoom as you can do, and obviously hide all the others that were there. And then give the message, give an apology, say there was going to be a follow-up call from HR, they would do this, and then be able to say, look, you know, really sorry for this, is really tight times, and there is no other way that we can do this, that's why we've had this collective call, and, you know, unfortunately, you've lost your job. Again, I'm not saying that's the best way forward, but for me personally, as somebody who coaches people around leadership communication, that is a bit more empathetic. Why would you want to do this? Why would you want to get rid of people like that? And who came to that kind of decision thinking that it was a really good decision to make? And I'm sure this is not going to be the only company that will be getting rid of staff or furloughing them or whatever it is to be able to adjust to these current really unprecedented and challenging times. But I still think there has to be an element of empathy. I still think that there's got to be a way as a leader that you have to treat your fellow worker or those who are under your direction as a leader with a lot of empathy and concern and treat them as a human. Now, last week, I was fortunate enough to deliver a keynote to a fabulous nonprofit organization that I'm a huge supporter of called the Marketing Academy. And while I was talking to them I delivered a keynote over another webinar tool, I was able to talk to them about a number of things. There were three things I wanted to talk to them about, actually. One of them was around brave thinking, which evidently and subsequently, not obviously, but subsequently leads to brave decision-making, and then thirdly, to brave choices. Now, the brave model that I have is something that I've talked about on this podcast a number of times, and people who follow me in any capacity in terms of the work that I do know my signature program is about brave leadership. I'll break it down again just for those who may have missed it. Brave is a model that I use. It says, as a leader, you should be, when you're communicating, you should be bold. You should be really strong in the conviction of what you're saying or doing, that you truly believe that. Secondly, you should be resilient. So recognize that you may get a bit of flack from some of the bold decisions that you're going to make, but it's about how do we bounce back and how do we encourage those under our leadership to also be resilient. Thirdly, is to be agile, to be flexible enough to recognize that in good and tough times that you're agile enough to reflect or to respond to the actual conditions that you are in alongside being resilient. Fourthly is to be visionary, so to have a sense of strategy or to have a sense of longer sight, far beyond the immediate circumstances that you find yourself in, to think about, you know, what are you going to be able to do in the future? And then lastly, to be ethical. And ethical is around ensuring that you take into consideration the values and beliefs and the dignity of those who are under your leadership. Now, the fifth one, should I say, ethical. I know a lot of organizations struggle with that one, that bit about ethical leadership. How do I really take into consideration the dignity of others when I have to make strong decisions? And more and more as I do my coaching and my consulting and my speaking work around leadership, more and more I'm recognizing the importance of ethical leadership. We are not cogs in a tool, and no matter how distancing running an organization, be it nonprofit, public sector, or third sector, I think it's so important to be able to have a sense of empathy and to build that into the kind of decision making that you are going to make. Yes, there may be instances because of the way that the model of the organization is that sometimes people may have to be let go, or people may have to be let go in tough times, or they may have even in good times, if they're not up to standard as to what you expect as in an organization, then you need to do that. But I think it's so important to do that in using that model again in a brave way, which is bold, which is also resilient, but also quite ethical. And looking back on this story that I mentioned at the beginning of Bird releasing that 400 odd staff, it really made me think about the stakeholders in those organizations, not just the executive committee, because obviously the investors and all those individuals who have a stake in the success of that company, really sitting down and thinking who thought it was a really good idea to be able to do that. That wasn't a brave move. If anything, I think that was a chicken move. I'm going to call them out and I'm going to say that was a chicken move. And if I was sitting down with the executives of that organization, I would really challenge them on why did they decide to go down that route? Why would they have not felt a lot better in being able to think of another way of whilst having to let staff go, still empowering them that they were a valuable contributor to the organization. And the only reason that you're really letting them go is because of the really strong times that we're against, but doing it with your, so people could see you as the face of the company, whoever the executive team was, being able to do that. And people who avoid that stuff, I think they're quite chicken, and I think it's quite embarrassing. And even if it wasn't just the executive, somebody who managers or other leaders will have known that, you know, this is the person at the helm. I understand that you brought me on board to go to this vision. Unfortunately, right now, we're not as able to do it as much as we can, but still, let's be able to respect all of you for your contribution. And for me, that was really disappointing. And so in order to be able to counteract that, I want to raise about three key points around decision-making in organizations for leaders for the purpose of this week's episode of the podcast. And I want to start with why I think it's so important that both the decisions that we make have to take into consideration the emotional and logical a balance between the two when we're making those decisions in the first place. And one of the first things for me, when I was even thinking about how I was going to put together this podcast, was the reading of a story that I came across in Forbes magazine a number of years ago. And it was a really good profile on a lady by the name of, I'm trying to remember her surname now, I should know this. I know her surname is Duke. Annie Duke. There we go. Annie Duke. Annie Duke was a successful poker player. Apparently she is the third highest earning woman poker player in the world, and she used to play on the World Series of Poker. And one of the things that came up in this article that I read, and I think it's back in 2014, was she came up with this idea of outcome blind analysis of decisions. And she basically talked about her journey as a poker player. And very often when she was playing in the game, she would try to read poker players. Try to read those ones who acted really aggressively, and those who she felt were, this is the easiest way to call their bluff, by their, you know, by a specific current behavior, and try to bet against it. And what she found that by doing that it was actually quite inaccurate. And she said that the majority of poker players that who played in a certain way by just observing the person in the moment, they missed a big trick. It was only by sitting back and recognizing the knowledge of that specific player's history and the behavior that they had at the moment, all these variables that came together allowed her to make a better decision. And again, she described what she just described for a lot of individuals who talk about mental models, and I'll talk about that a bit later on, is a method of seeing the world, which is called outcome blind. And for those who don't know what outcome blind is, essentially what you do is you have a look and get as much information as possible. And when you get that information, as much information as possible, it allows you to make a higher quality decision because you've taken as much probability into the outcome as possible. And a lot of people feel that their decisions are made based on if they've won, that it's because they made a good decision. Or if they lose, it's just because they're unlucky. And essentially, what Duke decided, or what Duke realized, is that was really, really misleading. Because just thinking that your wins or your loss were just on the basis of the hand you have, or the luck, it missed out all the other behaviors that you would have been able to notice, all the different variables, and all the different decisions that would be made along the way that would make you win that hand. And she realized by being able to speak to her peer group and her mastermind group while playing poker, that many of them shared the same process by looking at all the variables, by looking at all the behaviors and all the history of what those players who you were up against. You saw specific patterns, and it was those patterns that you based your decision on rather than if you were lucky or unlucky in the past in the way that you had won. And there was something really powerful that I remember reading from this article. And she says, you know, when you make an important business decision, the probability of failure might be 25% or more. And in many instances, it's because you have incomplete information. So the outcome, in some degree, is out of your control, but the process is in your control. And she makes an incredible point that there are a number of senior executives and leaders in businesses that if they could actually just take a step back from the situation, that they can think stronger rather than thinking it's all about them, looking at the situation outside of them, maybe be blind to the outcome of us as individuals and look at the bigger picture as a whole, rather than just being able to focus on ourselves. We look bigger, we look at our stakeholders, we look at the individuals who will be affected by the decisions that we're making. And rather than thinking it's just about us, think about what happens outside of us. What does that bigger picture look like? And there was an amazing point. I'm just looking at the article here on my machine now. She said, be humble before the world humbles you. I love you. I love you. I love that. I might love her as well. But I love that statement. Be humble before the world humbles you. And she was talking about a CEO that she's coaching. And she said, you know, when you start to think about making outcome blind decisions, you create a culture. For those of you who know me, you know I'm very much about how do we add to culture? How do we create dynamic cultures that people feel part and parcel of it? But she says, when you start to use this outcome blind approach, it creates a culture where people are encouraged to replay the tape on their decisions, acknowledge their mistakes, and then learn from them. I'll say that again. Replay the tape on your decisions, acknowledge the mistakes that you've made, and then learn from them. And that makes you smarter. Because rather than just thinking it's just about you, you think about all the different variables and the environment as a whole that you're actually working with. And I encourage a lot of leaders to just get out of just taking an emotional approach to stuff. Yes, you may be emotional literate, but when you are just basing it on emotion, you're only looking at it through a prism or through a window that's just based on your emotion. And when you are running a business or an organization of any form, making really good decisions means that you've got to go wider than what's in your emotion. You have to go logical, which is where it brings me to my second part, and that's understanding mental models. Now, I talk about this all the time. I'm a big fan of it. And there are some incredible podcasts like the Farnham Street podcast and so many others out there that talk about mental models and what they specifically are and why it's so important for leaders and organizations to have them. In a nutshell, the mental model is how you view and understand the world. It's basically your operating system that's in your brain, how you process stuff, how you have a specific frame of mind. Now, if you're only operating from emotional, you're not going to make a replicable mental model that other people can follow. Whereas when you start to look at mental models as a whole, you realize they take a step back. They tend to be a bit more logical. They tend to look a bit more at data. And having these mental models allows you to then think about, all right, given this situation, how can I look at it from an economic point of view or a biological point of view or a business point of view? What are those views or tools I have in my kit to make me do this better? I remember on LinkedIn, I made a post a couple of weeks back where I asked people about some webinars that I could do. And I think one of the ones that came up, which was quite popular, was about how you can use mental models to make better decisions. And I'm still going to be doing one of the webinars on there and just identifying a few of those mental models. But for now, I just wanted to bring it to the attention of my audience as to why I think it's so important. Charlie Munger, who I talk about, is co-founder of Berkshire Hathaway. He talks about building a lattice work or having a whole a range of mental models in your heads that you can choose from. Now, Munger and Buffett are famed for whichever way you obviously approach their method of capitalism and competitiveness. They are famed for the fact that they spend a hell of a lot of time reading and making decisions based on mental models. So they start to see things and process it through like chess players. And for me, as a leader, I think it's so important for my clients who I work with or anybody I speak to understand that when you are making decisions and powerful decisions that not only affect you, but all the other stakeholders in your organization, that you need to choose from the best resources that are possible for you. And having this lattice work, as Charlie Munger calls it, this toolbox or this range of models that you can actually choose from when you are making a decision makes for a really powerful choice at the end of the day. So having those mental models, and there are loads. I can think of, if I can give you some now without going to this, the map is not the territory, which is a simple model around recognizing that maps only represent the territory that we're actually approaching, but it's not the actual territory itself. It's just a snapshot in time. Circle of competence, making sure that you do things within the areas that you're really strong and finding other people who can help you outside of that, who can do that. Let's take Occam's razor. Simple explanations are more likely to be true than complicated ones. And then you also have Hanlon's razor. And that we should not attribute to malice that which is more easily explained by stupidity. Right about now, I start to think of some of the way that some governments have approached this COVID-19 and how they're creating healthcare and trying to reduce it, infection. And I think of Hanlon's razor and I can really apply it. I'm not going to go into too deep here, but I can really start to think here how I would rather apply stupidity to some of the decisions that I've made rather than malice for the individuals that are actually doing it. And there are so many more in science, things like feedback loops, things like homeostasis and equilibrium, the law of diminishing returns. We're talking about churn when we're talking about businesses, multiplicity by zero. In microeconomics, you can talk about things like the opportunity costs, comparative advantage, and there's so many more. I think about business planning, you're looking about the way that you actually use like visual tools, PEST, political, economic, social, technology, when you're thinking about that in terms of the choices that you're going to make for business. All these tools are available to individuals, and it's a question of immersing yourself in tools that are not just influenced by emotion, but take a step back and think about how you're going to make a logical conclusion. And again, as I said, I'm going to be doing a webinar soon, so if you follow me on any of the platforms or my website, davidmcqueen.co.uk, you'll see that I'm going to put up a webinar very soon for people who want to get a bigger understanding of what those mental models look like in practice. But for me, that second part is to understand our mental models so that we can think about how we make better decisions and how those mental models will impact our decisions. And the last one about decision-making that I want to talk about is really tackling cognitive biases. Now, a lot of the work that I do, specifically around culture development and leadership, I tackle how, as leaders, we deal with our own biases. Historically, I know that having worked with some organizations who are trying to widen representation and to create programs that take into consideration the underrepresentation of, say, women through gender, through race and ethnicity, sexual orientation, ability, age, all these things which in many organizations, larger organizations, tend to be underrepresented. Sometimes I get called in to have these conversations with senior teams and management about how can they address this gap? How can they address the lack of movement in hiring, keeping, and promoting individuals from underrepresented groups? And often it gets pushed into this diversity and inclusion corner, and more often than not, people just default towards unconscious bias. And for me, I'm not a big fan. I believe that, yes, it's okay. Other people may use a tool and may find it really applicable, but I only find that it makes people feel guilty for one day and then they move on and no one really thinks about it. I tend to go a level up, if I can, and focus on cognitive biases. What are those biases that stop us from making the right decisions when it comes to hiring, when it comes to firing, when it comes to working with our teams, when it comes to making those important decisions? And I want to talk about three cognitive biases right about now that I think people should be really aware of when, as a leader, you are starting to make a decision. So one is, and I know this is quite cultural, one is the Dunning-Kruger effect. And this is a tendency for individuals to overestimate their own ability, whether they are a layperson, whether they are an expert, they overestimate what it is that they are capable of and capable of doing. And so when they're coming to make the decisions, they feel that they're in a position where they can make a decision outside of their circle of competence, which is one of the models I spoke about earlier. Now, often, if you have individuals in your team who keep you accountable, whether you're a senior leadership team, a middle leader, or an emerging leader, there's a hell of a lot of emphasis to be placed on accountability so that you try and test and just try and see as many scenarios as possible and try and see, like I talked about in the poker example, trying to see how many variables there are and learn from them so that when you are faced with a decision, you can actually make a really good decision based on data. Something like the Dunning effect, a lot of people, Dunning-Kruger effect, a lot of people aren't willing to admit it, but sometimes it's just outside your scope of competence. And being really aware of what that actually looks like, and again, through coaching, we do this through questions. We really test people, we push them as to how they are making decisions, and we question them on examples of where it has worked or where it hasn't worked, or what their competence really is. And again, it's somewhere between being overconfident and imposter syndrome. You want to get somewhere in the middle where you feel a lot more confident about the decision you're making and not being overinflated or feeling that you're not good enough, but somewhere that sweet spot right in the middle where you start to make better decisions that are not outside of your scope, but within the framework of what you actually know. Let me give you a quick second one. Confirmation bias. Okay? And the this one is a really interesting one because I know so many times I've had to check myself on this one. But we look for or we see data in such a way that we have, when we see it, it confirms or reconfirms our own perceptions about things that happen. So say, for example, one of the struggles that I have with politically is that when I look at something like the Tory party, the Conservative Party, that is the political party that govern the country at the moment, it's very difficult sometimes to take a step back from the notion that I have in my head of that whatever they do wrong. So say, for example, there's a lack of shortage of equipment right about now with this this world global crisis that we have. And for me, it's almost like typical that a political party that doesn't place much emphasis on a nationalized health service will willfully allow for equipment and the reaction to a crisis not to be as quick as it should be. Now, the truth is that I have no evidence to back that up. There would be an assumption. Yes, there were studies that went past from before as to how in 2016, I think the National Health did a role play, an exercise, a game plan as to what would actually happen if there's a pandemic. But I have no evidence in front of me to say that any other political party that would have been there in, at the same time would have been able to do any better than that one. So I have to park my own confirmation biases and look at the data in front of me. And then once I've got the data, start to build it. And rather than just assuming because of a narrative that I've created in my head about this political party, I've got to look at the facts that are in front of us and look at the data and look how people responded and then make conclusions based on that. And dealing with our own confirmation biases is one of the toughest things as leaders, but it's an important thing because if you feel, for example, that you're hiring a young woman is not going to be good because if you hire a young woman at some point in her tenure heading towards leadership, she may get pregnant and that may disrupt the company, that's going to stop you from hiring individuals. If, for example, you are, and I've known this to happen a lot of times, that you have a confirmation bias that hiring a Nigerian or a West African, no matter how gifted they are, may create some issue in the future around fraud. And I've spoken to recruiters and off the record and hiring managers who have been told from higher up that they are reluctant to hire from a specific demographic in financial services because of this assumption. That's a confirmation bias. At the most extreme case, that's racism. But on a smaller case, it's just about being able to tackle that bias in your head when we're thinking about hiring, when we're thinking about decision-making, when we're thinking about firing. What are the things that we have in our mind that just confirm the biases that we already have and what can we do to actually change them? And then the last one that I wanted to talk about was the bandwagon effect. And the bandwagon effect as a cognitive bias is we just do it. It's like groupthink. We just do things because we believe that's the way that they should be done. And effectively, because you know, in the past that others have done it, we feel this is the same way to go forward. And if that is how we make decisions, then I challenge people. I challenge individuals to think of a different way of being able to approach this. How can we do things from a different angle based on some really good mental models, based on some really good experience, using things like outcome blind as a way of being able to measure and get the best result possible. Now, I know it's a bit heavy, and I make no apologies for it because I think it's important to be able to make really good decisions as a leader. And on the surface, it may seem really simple. And again, I've only really scratched the surface here with some of the issues that as leaders we have to deal with outside of our areas of expertise, outside of the areas that brought us to that point just before we became leaders. There's a bigger picture. It is about how you make decisions that will affect the organization for the mid to long term. It is about how you create models around how that thinking has to be done in the first place. It is about being awareness of your being aware of your emotional literacy, but not using that as the basis for actually making a decision. And it is also about being able to tackle those cognitive biases. Those three things for me are an incredible part of the toolkit that myself and other leadership coaches have in order to be able to empower our clients and the organizations that we work with to make the best decisions possible. And for me, being able to take a journey and a real deep journey into thinking about what those tools are, what those models are, what those biases are, and how we can pull them together so that we can make the best decision as leaders in our organizations, in our community, whatever it is we're doing. For me, those things are incredibly important. And I hope in some way that individuals will be able to think more about how important it is to take the time out to make decisions that will last and will leave a good reputation for their leadership, but also have a massive impact on the organizations that they are working for. Whew. I enjoyed doing that. And I thank you for listening to this week's episode. And I hope that these tips or insights by myself have helped someone in leadership to think about how their thinking and their network will help them to become even greater leaders. In the next few episodes, I'm going to be exploring some things, a few more things around that model that I have, around empathetic leadership, around ethical leadership, around resilience, around conflict management, all these things I want to be able to address. I do have a couple of people that I've interviewed, but I just want to get through a stream of these ones first, and then we'll move on to a lot of the interviews that I have and I have lined up. And I know they will make for an interesting conversation. But again, I thank you for taking the time out to listen to this episode. It's good to be back on here and starting to record again, getting that energy. As always, you can get this Spotify, you can get this podcast, should I say, on Spotify, iTunes, and Google Play. That's where it is at the moment. I'm looking to extend it so that there are other platforms that you can pick them up from. But what I'd love you to do is just go ahead and share this podcast with anybody who you know would be able to benefit from it, whether it's emerging leaders, middle leaders, or senior leaders, or anybody just really interested in the whole area of leadership communication. And always, any comments or ratings that you have on any other platforms that you get this on, I'd appreciate that as well. Thank you for taking your time out to listen and any feedback you give. And I look forward to having you tune in to the next episode of Leadership Recovery. Thank you. Until next time, take care.